Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Pistorius testifies that he had no intention of killing Rivas Denkamp, and the UN is to authorize a new peacekeeping force for the CAR. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. South African runner Oscar Pistorius has testified that he did not intend to kill his girlfriend, Rivas Denkamp, or anyone else the night he shot her last year. In his third day on the witness stand today, the prosecution began a tough cross-examination by pressing Pistorius to say he takes responsibility for her killing. He broke down in tears after the lead prosecutor, Jerry Nell, displayed a graphic picture of Stenkamp's bloody head.
My lady, I was there that night.
That's it. Have a look there, mister. I know you don't want to because you don't want to take responsibility, but it's time that you look at it. Take responsibility for what you've done, Mr. Pistorius.
My lady, I've taken responsibility by me waiting and not wanting to live my life, but waiting for my time on this stand to tell my story for the respect of Riva and for myself. I've taken responsibility, but I will not look at a picture where I'm tormented by what I saw and felt that night.
Pistorius began his testimony today recounting the moments after the shooting, saying he felt helpless while waiting for paramedics to arrive at his Pretoria home. You can read more details on this story as it develops at voanews.com. The United Nations Security Council is set to authorize a new expanded peacekeeping force for the Central African Republic. The Security Council on Thursday is expected to adopt a resolution calling for a force of 10,000 soldiers and 1,800 police to help restore order in the country. According to a draft resolution seen by VOA, the UN force will be operational by September 15th, when it will take over from the existing African force in the CAR. 6,000 African troops and 2,000 French troops have been unable to contain sectarian violence that has killed thousands of people. Search crews in the Indian Ocean have reacquired the underwater signal they believe could belong to the flight data recorder of the missing Malaysian jetliner. The Australian search chief, Angus Houston, said the transmissions were detected by a U.S. Navy towed pinger locator on two separate occasions on Tuesday.
Ocean Shield has now detected four transmissions in the same broad area. Yesterday's signals will assist in better defining a reduced and much more manageable search area on the ocean floor. I believe we are searching in the right area, but we need to visually identify aircraft wreckage before we can confirm with certainty that this is the final resting place of MH370.
Authorities are running out of time as the battery on the plane's black box locator beacon that transmit those pings lasts only for about 30 days. A bomb explosion in a fruit and vegetable market on the outskirts of the Pakistani capital today has killed at least 21 people and injured dozens of others. Ayaz Ghul reports.
Witnesses and police say the bomb went off in a section of the bustling market where traders had gathered in large numbers for early morning fruit auctions. Investigators suspected the explosive material was planted in a fruit carton. This shopkeeper says the high-intensity blast sent victims and their body parts flying, and there were bodies scattered all over the area. Rescue teams shifted the dead and wounded to the Pakistan Institute of Medical Sciences in the capital and to a hospital in the neighboring city, Rawalpindi. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Ukraine's interior minister is warning that standoffs with pro-Russian demonstrators in three eastern regions must be resolved in the next 48 hours, either through negotiations or by force. Arsen Avakov told reporters today that a political solution is still possible, but he vowed protesters who want conflict will get a forceful answer from Ukrainian authorities. Pro-Moscow groups have seized several government buildings in eastern Ukraine and demanded a vote on joining Russia in a dramatic escalation of the protests against the Western-friendly interim government. Italy says it has rescued 4,000 migrants from the Mediterranean Sea in the past 2 days. The country's interior minister told Italian state radio today that migrant rescues and landings have been nonstop and migrant emergency is getting worse. He is demanding the European Union do more to help police Mediterranean waters, saying tens of millions of dollars have failed to solve the problem. VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The medical aid group, Doctors Without Borders, describes conditions at a camp for the displaced in South Sudan as appalling. It accuses the UN mission, UNMISS, of not doing enough to protect thousands of people there. UN officials deny the accusation and say protecting civilians is their top concern.
That's VOA's Jody Capua reporting. Details next.
Also in the news, recent improvements in national security have led to growing optimism that Somalia could finally be taking steps towards lasting stability. And a Cairo court refuses to appoint new judges for the trial of Mohamed Morsi, charged with jailbreak and spying.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Cameroon, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders describes conditions at a camp for the displaced in South Sudan as appalling. It accuses the UN mission UNMISS of not doing enough to protect thousands of people there. UN officials deny the accusation and say protecting civilians is their top concern. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
About 21,000 people are crowded into the Tomping UN peacekeeping base in Juba. People fled to the base after fighting broke out between government forces and rebels in December. Stefan Lillegrien, MSF project coordinator in Juba, describes conditions in Tomping.
They are cramped up in a very, very tiny area, which is known to be flood-prone. And floods has already happened due to rain. The humanitarian organizations have been pushing for more space. The UN MISS here in Juba are really putting a lot of obstacles for humanitarians working here in this area. One obstacle after the other are being presented to us. Instead of finding solutions for the problems, they are postponing and changing ideas, and they're giving a piece of land and taking it back again.
He says just getting from shelter to shelter is a problem.
People have their houses in standing water, and to reach to a lot of these houses now, you have to walk through water that are 10, 15, 20 centimeters deep.
MSF warns conditions are ripe for an epidemic of diarrheal, respiratory, and skin diseases. UNMISS has announced plans to close the Tomping camp next month and move people to a base known as UN House or Juba House. It's on higher ground. The MSF project coordinator says it sounds good, but there are problems.
It's not a bad idea to move these people to another location, but the time framing on this is completely out of sync because the new place will not be ready in time to move these people. And meantime, more space needs to be allocated within the UN compound so we can prevent potential very bad spread of diseases here.
Lilje Grien says heavy rains will greatly slow or block any move to the UN House location, which already holds 11,000 displaced people. What's more, he says, that humanitarian groups have encountered repeated obstacles or refusals from UNMISS to get more space in Tomping.
Some people are really understanding the situation and are really helping us, but then local commanders or battalion chiefs are blocking, no, you cannot have this space because I need it for my battalion, and some other commanders say, no, I need this one for containers, and another one say, I need this, and nobody's giving.
He rejects UNMISS's assertion that it's doing all it can to help and protect civilians.
They are not doing everything they can, not at all. They could have done a lot more, a lot sooner. We have been asking for this for a long time.
UNMISS spokesperson Ariane Quantier agrees conditions are bad at the Tomping base, saying the situation is of great concern.
It is of great concern for two reasons. One is that this place is not meant and appropriate to have thousands of people living there, but it is congested. And it's always been congested from the first day because people literally flocked into our site, fleeing for safety when the violence erupted. The other concern is, of course, the rainy season. That makes the conditions even worse.
She says UNMISS is well aware of the danger of a possible disease outbreak.
If you take the combination of these two elements, which is the congestion of the camp and the rainy season, you have a situation where these protection sites are turning into death trap, because if there is an outbreak of disease, this will spread throughout the area like wildfire.
Quantier says UNMISS has a two-part strategy to deal with the situation.
One is to try to have people relocating on a voluntary basis to other areas. What I'm calling other areas is either extension of existing sites that we have on our compound or new sites on land made available to us by the government. And this is something we've asked the authorities from the very first day, to have more land to be able to decongest the site.
About 1,500 people of the 21,000 at Tamping have been relocated to other sites so far. Part two of the strategy, she says, is improving conditions at existing sites, including water, sanitation, and basic health services.
We have been saving thousands of lives by the mere fact of opening our gates and having, for the last 3.5 months, over 80,000 people who have stayed on our bases. And I think this is what the people wanted. They voted with their feet. They are still on our side. And I think UNMISS has saved 85,000 lives, plus prevented the country in descending into worse chaos.
Quantier says UNMISS has a duty to protect them. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
For years, Somali has been referred to as a failed state synonymous with piracy, poverty, and terrorism. Recent improvements in national security, however, have led the growing optimism that the country could finally be taking steps towards lasting stability. Somali officials say a stronger economy is vital to prolonged peace, and this week traveled to the United Arab Emirates with the hope of attracting foreign investment to the war-torn nation. Philip Walter Wellman reports from Dubai.
Participants at the Somali Investment Summit in Dubai painted a different picture of the East African country than the one the world has become familiar with.
If in past years the image was hunger, piracy, terrorism. Today, if you will see a different scenario, you will see a light at the end of the tunnel. You will see hope, and that life is coming back. So this is the image we now want to show.
That was Ali Mohamed Gedi, the former prime minister of Somalia's transitional federal government. Growing stability in Somalia, which is grappling with a two-decade-old civil war, can largely be attributed to outside intervention. Over the past year, African Union troops helped drive al-Shabaab militants from major cities, and out at sea, international naval patrols led to a significant decrease in pirate attacks. But Getty warns that the outcome of these efforts could be short-lived unless more is done to address the underlying problem of poverty among the Somali population.
The young generation who have been employed by al-Shabaab, they are not ideologically radicalists, but for their survival. So if we create jobs for them, I believe that they play a role in the stabilization and the security of the country.
Hassan Dude, the chairman of the Somali Economic Forum, agrees that the lure of illegal activity, and especially piracy, will always be great when employment opportunities do not exist. He says attracting investment to Somalia now, when the security situation is improving, is crucial, as it will create jobs and help promote safety not only in the country, but throughout the region.
I think what the international organizations and international community is starting to realize is that bringing troops to Somalia will not be the answer to this problem. When people have jobs and you know, better life, of course, they will be less likely to get in trouble.
While conditions in Somalia have been improving, they're by no means ideal for investors. In addition to safety threats and the lack of a central government, corruption is rife and there's an absence of a skilled workforce. There is also no secure legal framework for foreign investors, although authorities are reportedly in the process of forming new legislation.
Investors are a bit afraid of actually going to situations like that, but there's a huge opportunity. The GDP growth of Somalia is equal to Ethiopia. It's actually higher than some of the stable African countries. Somalia is growing. The economy is growing.
That was Hirsi Darir, the CEO of Dahabshil Bank, which operates 130 branches in the country. Analysts say Somalia has substantial potential natural resources, including agriculture, livestock, fishing, and hydrocarbons, Its telecommunications sector is also expected to attract future investors. Although an increase in stability has led to a growing number of investments from overseas, overall activity remains weak. The United Arab Emirates, Oman, and Yemen are the leading investing nations in Somalia. This is Philip Walter Wellman for VOA News, Dubai.
Fifteen minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. A Cairo court refused to appoint new judges for the trials of Mohamed Morsi, the nation's ousted former president. Morsi and other Muslim Brotherhood supporters are charged with jailbreak and spying. The trials are part of a government crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood, which has been outlawed. More than 1,400 have died in the violence and thousands arrested. In another court, 18 Morsi supporters today were sentenced 3 to 7 years in jail on charges of inciting a riot during a July demonstration in Cairo's Soubra district. Public demonstrations must have prior approval by the government.
Morsi could face the death penalty if convicted in his two trials. Lawyers for the defendants requested new judges, but an appeals court turned down the request. Morsi and 130 others are accused of organizing a jailbreak and attacking police stations during the 2011 uprising that toppled ex-president Hosni Mubarak. Many of the defendants are Palestinians and Lebanese militants. Morsi and 35 others are accused of conspiring with the Palestinian Islamist movement Hamas and Shiite Iran to destabilize Egypt. Morsi also faces trial on charges of inciting supporters to attack opposition demonstrators during his year in office.
More than 150,000 Ethiopian migrants have been expelled from Saudi Arabia. The International Organization of Migration, IOM, partnered with the Ethiopian government and civil society groups to engage Ethiopians in alternatives to migration and to look at ways to combat what is now called irregular migration. Forums called Community Conversations will train more than 800 community conversation facilitators in the next 2 months. This will include religious and community leaders and representatives of vulnerable groups, including women and the elderly. Leonette Demsis specializes in irregular migration, human trafficking, and smuggling for IOM in Ethiopia. She spoke with me about their new program by first explaining what is meant by irregular migration.
There's no clear or universally accepted definition of irregular migration. However, in IOM, we understand irregular migration as a movement that takes place outside the regulatory norms of sending, transit, and receiving countries. From the perspective of destination countries, it's entry, stay, or work in a country without the necessary authorization or documents required under immigration regulations.
Why is it important to have this type of a forum, community conversations?
One of the reasons is, like in communities, especially in rural Ethiopia, most community members are not fully aware of the full extent of the risks involved in irregular migration. Our survey conducted end of 2013 indicated that though some of them are aware of the risks involved, irregular migration in terms of their lives, sexual violence and the like, or kidnapping, all this, but they don't, because of their age, their understanding of the world and everything, they don't really understand the full extent of the risks involved.
What would be an example of the type of information a young person who is considering migration, considering to leave, what kind of information would they receive at the forum?
In this forum, it will be comprised of community leaders, parents. For instance, there is a smallest administrative unit in a community, which is Qabale, in Ethiopian context. And there are Qabale managers and also community leaders, assigned religious leaders, women and girls. At the same time, parents will be involved in this community conversations. So when they are involved, they'll have a chance to channel this information to different levels in the society. The main potential migrants are young girls and boys making this decision, but they are financed by their parents. Parents should be informed, and also they can play a critical role in influencing the decisions of their children.
How will you all be training people to provide information to people?
One of the things, like, we have developed a conversation manual. In this manual, what we are trying to do is the first important point is for them to understand the concept behind migration, like what's irregular migration, human trafficking and smuggling and the like. Because in some cases, when people are living without acquiring the necessary documents, they don't really know that they are violating another sovereign country. So it's also important for community members at the grassroots level to understand all these concepts. So establishing this concept is key, one element, for them to understand very well what's irregular migration, human trafficking, smuggling, mixed flows, and the like. So once they understand and fully comprehend these elements, they can also see how they can channel this information to communities at grassroots level, where we see resonating this information to all levels of the community.
The unit DEMSIS specializes in irregular migration, human trafficking, and smuggling for IOM in Ethiopia. She spoke with me from Addis Ababa.
Years after close to 1 million people were slaughtered in the Rwandan genocide, U.S. military officials are confident that forces are better positioned to prevent a repeat of such mass slaughter. But as VOA's Jeff Selden reports from the Pentagon, Washington is still concerned about security across the African continent.
Fears run rampant across much of the Central African Republic, where 2,000 people have been killed in ethnic violence since December, and some African peacekeepers have already pulled out. But U.S. defense officials say that African forces have been able to intervene is a sign things are slowly improving.
The African forces that now are available that participate in these intervention and those type of things have expanded incredibly in the last 20 years. I mean, six nations in Somalia, nine going to 16 in Mali.
And the commander of the U.S. Africa Command, General David Rodriguez, says American forces are also better positioned to respond, with as many as 6,000 troops on the ground, including some at a forward operating base in Djibouti and trainers in Uganda, aiding the effort to track and stop warlord Joseph Kony and his Lord's Resistance Army.
They continue to get weaker every day, and we're going to continue to support the efforts of the African Union Regional Task Force to finish this off.
But deep concerns remain about the growing nexus of extremists, especially in northeastern Mali and southwestern Libya. Rodriguez points to the 2013 attack on a gas facility in En Amenas, Algeria, where three al-Qaeda-linked groups joined forces.
They're also transferring things that are very worrisome, like the IED technology and tactics, techniques, and procedures.
In addition, U.S. defense officials say they and their African partners worry about the flow of extremist fighters to Syria and their eventual return across sometimes porous borders. But even as U.S. forces draw down from Afghanistan, Deputy Assistant Defense Secretary for African Affairs Amanda Dory says don't expect a heavier U.S. presence in Africa.
Our small footprint and targeted support, working with willing partners, fulfills both our own strategic approach and is the way our African partners prefer to work with us.
However, U.S. officials do say they are considering ways to improve military capabilities, especially in West Africa. Jeff Selden, VOA News, The Pentagon.
Coming up on 24 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The World Health Organization is issuing its first ever global guidelines on treating hepatitis C, a liver disease that kills between 350,000 and 500,000 people every year. WHO says the guidelines will reduce deaths from hepatitis C by helping countries improve treatment and care. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization says between 130 and 150 million people globally have chronic hepatitis C infection. The most affected regions are Central and East Asia and North Africa. The hepatitis C virus is mainly spread through exposure to contaminated blood. This can happen through unsafe healthcare practices involving the reuse of needles and syringes. A significant number of people who are chronically infected with hepatitis C will develop liver cirrhosis or liver cancer. WHO is publishing its guidelines as more effective and safer oral hepatitis medicines become more readily available on the market. Stefan Wichter, head of WHO's Global Hepatitis Program, says hepatitis C can be treated and cured, and he says treatments are getting better all the time.
Up until recently, to treat somebody with hepatitis C was required approximately 48 weeks of weekly injections of medicine called interferon, which was very toxic, very difficult to take, and really discouraged people from taking the medicine. Now the newer treatments are much shorter, 12 weeks. Some of them are treated without any injections at all and result in more than 90% cure rates.
Unfortunately, Dr. Wichter says most people in the world do not receive treatment for this illness. This is largely due to the lack of awareness of the problem and the lack of healthcare workers trained to recognize and deal with the disease. However, he notes the biggest problem is that most people do not have any symptoms. Therefore, they do not know they may be at risk and should be tested. He says the infection too often remains undiagnosed until serious liver damage has developed. Another major problem is hepatitis C treatment is unaffordable for most patients. Dr. Wichter says the newer drugs can cost as much as $84,000 for a 12-week course of treatment. He acknowledges price is a huge challenge to overcome.
To bridge that gap between the promise of these new medicines and sort of the reality of low coverage, we are issuing, WHO developed its first ever treatment guidelines. And these guidelines, since they come with the WHO seal of approval and are strongly evidence-based, we feel will be an important tool for decision-makers in countries who are considering starting or scaling up hepatitis treatment programs to give them the recommendations that they can use to help guide the development of that program. Similarly, they can help healthcare workers in how to manage patients.
The new guidelines provide recommendations on screening for hepatitis C infection, on medical care to slow the progress of the disease, and on safe and effective treatments to cure chronic hepatitis C infection. They also suggest measures that can be taken to prevent the transmission of the hepatitis C virus. These include instructions on safe medical procedures regarding injections in a healthcare setting and among people who inject drugs. WHO officials say they are sure the price of treatment will come down dramatically as more people use and benefit from the new drugs. They note that treatment for HIV/AIDS used to cost $10,000 when it was first introduced. They say the same and better drugs now cost $100. WHO says competition from generic HIV drug manufacturers, mainly in India, and the huge expansion of the market for these drugs has driven down prices, making it much cheaper for governments to scale up treatment. It says it expects a similar downward spiral in the price of hepatitis C drugs to occur. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And South African runner Oscar Pistorius says he did not intend to kill his girlfriend Reeva Steenkamp or anyone else the night he shot her at his Pretoria home last year. In his third day of testimony today, Pistorius told the court he felt helpless while waiting for an ambulance to arrive, but that by the time paramedics came, it was too late. Pistorius has told the court he thought he was shooting at an intruder when he fired through a locked bathroom door. Prosecutors say Pistorius intentionally shot Steenkamp. In his first responses to the prosecutor's cross-examination today, Pistorius said he made a terrible mistake in taking Reeva's life. This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello,
I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders describes conditions at a camp for the displaced in South Sudan as appalling. And a Cairo court refuses to appoint new judges for the trial of Mohamed Morsi, charged with jailbreak and spying. Coming up, we'll have music from Cameroon. And next, a global movement to remember and educate people about what happened in Rwanda. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehaya Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand European club football tops your sports report today.
Kim, let's kick off with European club football. The big matches this evening are in Munich, Germany, and Madrid, Spain. Bayern Munich will host Manchester United, and Atletico Madrid is at home against Spanish rival Barcelona in the decisive second legs of the UEFA Champions League quarterfinals. Both first leg matches ended in 1-1 draws. In action Tuesday night, Chelsea of England and Real Madrid of Spain both advanced to the semifinals. Madrid reached the Final Four for the fourth season in a row with a 3-2 aggregate win following a 2-0 loss at Borussia Dortmund. And Chelsea got a late goal from Senegalese star Demba Ba to cap a comeback from a 2-goal aggregate deficit against Paris Saint-Germain. Chelsea beat PSG 2-0, and while the series ended 3-3 on aggregate, the Blues of Chelsea moved on because of away goals. After Ba's dramatic goal in the 87th minute, the Chelsea fans and players were in a joyous mood, and Chelsea's Portuguese manager, Jose Mourinho, ran out onto the pitch. At the post-match news conference in London, Mourinho made his actions clear.
No, was not to celebrate. Was to tell the players how we have to play the last 10 minutes, because I know in that moment they want to celebrate. They want to think that the game is over. They forget that you still have three plus other 3 or 4 minutes to play. And the way we were playing, we couldn't carry on winning 2-0. So I had to go there because I know it's the only chance I have to tell them and Fernando and Schürrle what we have to do in the last 7 or 8 minutes. So it was not to celebrate. But you could see that I can run.
Yes, I could see that you can run, coach. Meanwhile, Mourinho says the UEFA Champions League semifinals are shaping up as a thrilling competition.
You know, we are in the semifinals. And if the quarterfinals had 8 fantastic teams, imagine the 4 that are going to reach the semifinal. So anything can happen. Big opponent is waiting for us in the semifinal, but I think it doesn't matter who. They know that we are a team with a special spirit, even if we are a team not in the maximum of our potential.
That's Jose Mourinho, the manager of Chelsea Football Club, speaking at Stamford Bridge in London. Joining us once again from Johannesburg is our African football guru, David Legg. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sonny.
David, I remember you saying last week that our VOA football fans could look forward to some exciting finishes in the English and Spanish leagues. How about an update?
Well, that's right, Sonny. As a proud Liverpool supporter, I'm very pleased to inform all our Voice of America listeners around the continent of Africa that if Liverpool can win the remaining 5 Premier League fixtures, they will win the title for the first time in 20 years. That's how exciting it is to be a fan of the Reds these days. And Heaven knows, Sonny, we've had some bad times recently. Manchester United, our greatest rivals, have dominated English football, so perhaps now it's time for a change. Liverpool have got 74 points with those five games to go, three at home and two away. And two of those home games are there against the clubs immediately below them, Chelsea and Manchester City. In fact, Sonny, this coming weekend could be ultimately a title decider because Liverpool face Manchester City at Anfield. And I feel if Liverpool can bag maximum points from that game, they could well be on their way to that elusive title. As mentioned, Liverpool have 74 points. Chelsea have got 72. Manchester City have got 70, but I must stress they have played two matches less than Liverpool or Chelsea. Arsenal, I feel, now out of the running with 64 points. Their big battle, Sonny, is to finish in the top four because the top four clubs qualify for the Champions League. And they're just 1 point ahead of Everton after losing 3-0 to the Toffees at the weekend. But Everton have that precious game in hand. And after Everton come Tottenham. And then in a rather strange position for them, Manchester United, only seventh at the moment with 57 points and clearly out of the running to win the title and almost certainly out of the running for a top four place and Champions League football next season. At the bottom end of the table, Sunderland with 25 points, Cardiff with 26 and Fulham with 27. And the gap between Fulham and the club immediately above them, Norwich, is 5 points. But interestingly, Fulham host Norwich this weekend. And to put it mildly, Fulham must win that game to have any hope of staying in the Premier Division. If we switch then, Sonny, to Spain, that exciting three-horse race towards the title continues. Atletico Madrid, Barcelona and Real Madrid all won. And the result of that is that with six rounds to go, Atletico got 79 points, Barcelona 78, and Real Madrid 76. And just to stress what we've said many times on the Sunny Side of Sport, in the very final round of matches this season, Barcelona are at home to Atletico Madrid. What price that the winners of that match will be crowned champions of Spain?
David, let's turn now to Zimbabwe. The country has had financial problems over the years, funding not just its national football team, the Warriors, but various sports. And it looks like the country continues to be cash-strapped. How about an update?
Yes, Sonny. Zimbabwe Football Association are in dire straits. They've got no money. They've had to withdraw their youth and junior teams from the African Championships and are now battling to find the money to bankroll the senior men's and women's teams in their respective tournaments. Now, something desperate had to be done, and I take my hat off to Cuthbert Dube. He's just been re-elected chairman of the Zimbabwe Football Association, who are known as ZIFA. He rightly pointed out that the sponsors who football in Africa rely on so much for cash, they're also battling these days. It is economically very tough in southern Africa. So Dube had to look elsewhere. And he was very quick to say that maybe some people will ask if I'm still all right in my head, but we are going to diversify into farming in a very big way. Now, what he's talking about is ZIFA getting some farms from the government and then growing crops and also doing cattle ranching. And Sonny, I've got nothing but admiration, provided, of course, there's a solid business plan and this is a feasible operation. But I think, you know, rather than just sulking and moaning and going begging to the government all the time, it seems to me that Zimbabwe football officials, they're looking out of the box. They're trying to come up with something different. And I just had a thought. I mean, Nigeria is another country where the National Football Association forever seemed to be linked with that cliche, cash strapped. Now, why don't they go into business just like the Zimbabweans are proposing? Let's open up some supermarkets. And as long as prices are competitive, I think the fact that Nigerians know that if they shop in those supermarkets, they're actually helping the super eagles, could really take off. Very interesting proposal indeed. And let's hope the Zimbabwean Sunny can make a success of it.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. Top African distance runners will test their speed and endurance in Sunday's London Marathon. The energetic Andy Edwards caught up with the 2011 champion and last year's runner-up from Kenya. Here's Andy.
We are talking with Emmanuel Mutai of Kenya, an illustrious runner who's won the Virgin Money London Marathon and was second last year. Emmanuel, yes. Can you compare your form this year with last, when you had a very good run to finish second?
For this year, I prepare myself very well for the Sunday. But, you know, for this time, I think competition will be a bit tough as compared as last year. What is in my mind is I just want to be more keen and prepare mentally. So because I know everybody will be looking for each other, but for me, I want to run my own race. But what determines this competition is how physically or mentally you are in your mind, so that you know when you want to break out, at what stage. So maybe I will have to be in the group until maybe the after 30 kilometers when the pacemaker will have gone. So that is now the beginning of how the race will be now.
You're the course record holder in London with 2 hours, 4 minutes and 40 seconds when you won the title. You also are a training partner sometimes with someone who's also running in the race, Stephen Kiprotich from Uganda, who's the Olympic and world champion. You do track work together. Does that give you an insight into one of your main rivals because you see him in training so much, one of your rivals for London?
Yes, of course, when you are training with somebody, you are going to compete with him. Of course, everybody wants to have a good results, but, you know, everybody, you know, for me now, maybe he's targeting me, and even me, maybe I'll be saying no, because we have been training together, so maybe I don't want him to beat me, but on that day, that is what would determine how strong I am, and he's also how strong he is. But, you know, during the training, sometimes maybe you relax behind or you are in front, but during the competition, you have to make a full effort that you run good for all energy you have.
There's always talk in London every year that the field is so strong. This year, it seems really, truthfully, stronger than ever that the world record might go. But what do you think the chances are of breaking the world record when you have such a strong field and you've got Haile Gebrselassie pacing the men's field through to 30 kilometres? What are the chances?
For me, the world record cannot be broken in London because I know it is the pace is so high. Maybe to 30 kilometers world record pace, it's okay. Even up to 35, it's okay. But towards the end, the course is so hard. So I don't think to break the world record in London is so easy, but it is so not so easy.
Well, I think we're all agreed on one thing, and that it is going to be a very, very tough men's race and a fascinating one. Emmanuel Mutai, a champion in London indeed. Good luck for the Virgin Money London Marathon 2014. All the best, Emmanuel.
Thank you.
And thank you, Andy Edwards, for that nice interview with Emmanuel Mutai, one of Kenya's great athletes ahead of Sunday's London Marathon. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Okay, thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, our series on the Rwandan genocide 20 years later. And next, a global movement to remember and educate people about what happened in Rwanda. But first, some music. Here is Deborah Debs of Cameroon with Africa Higher and Higher.
No.
is priceless. But yourself upon its throne. Hey, yeah, yeah. 20 years for power.
What?
30 plus and 14 more.
30 plus and 14 more.
All the worries that my family and my friends their family.
Deborah Dibbs of Cameroon with Africa, Higher and Higher.
Well, as Rwanda marks 20 years since the genocide, a group of visitors from a U.S. Holocaust memorial are touring sites around the Rwandan countryside, drawing connections between two of the worst atrocities in the 20th century. VOA's Gabe Jostle reports on the significance of memorials for confronting the pain of the past.
You can see how what has been a way to kill them. Some of them have been macheted mostly, a machete that did a spectacular work during the genocide, and as they were distributed from.
A wooden shelf stacked floor to ceiling with skulls and bones fills the back wall of the Interahamwe Church Memorial outside Kigali. It was here, a tour guide explains, that some 5,000 people were killed during the genocide of 1994. Coffins of some of the dead lie on the pews. The victims' ragged clothing hangs from strings tied to the ceiling. Angelique Mukapukizi was one of the few survivors of the attack here. A young mother at the time, she only survived because the killers who thought they were executing her did not realize after they finished hacking at her body that she was still alive. Now, bearing scars on her neck and arms, she tells her harrowing story to this group of visitors from the United States. As difficult as her experience has been, she feels it is crucial to tell the world what happened in this place. If someone comes to visit the memorial and asks me for the testimony, she says, I do it confidently. It is like showing him the history of Rwanda. We cannot hide it, and if he understands it, it can be a good lesson for him and the rest of the world. The group visiting this day knows full well the importance of learning lessons from the past. It is part of a delegation from the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington. Michael Abramovitz, the director of the museum's Center for the Prevention of Genocide, says one of the main functions of memorial sites is to ensure that history is not forgotten.
And we really want to focus part of our efforts at the museum on raising awareness, raising consciousness about the fact that genocide did not end after the Holocaust, sadly, and that we still have a long way to go in realizing our collective vision of never again.
Touring these memorial sites in Rwanda, he says, is a different experience from visiting a museum.
Well, first of all, we are only 20 years after the genocide in Rwanda, and we're about 75 years after the Holocaust. And so what happened here is raw, and obviously there is no substitute for actually being on the place where these crimes happened. That's a very powerful thing.
There are numerous sites across Rwanda, like the Interahamwe Church, where the real bodies of victims are left on display, and the walls still bear bullet holes describing unspeakable violence, powerful reminders to the living of the not-so-distant past. Ildefonso Karengera, director of Memory and Prevention of Genocide at Rwanda's Anti-Genocide Commission, says these emotional memorial sites give victims a space to confront the past and to find some comfort.
It takes them back to the period in which they were living during genocide, but at the same time also it is a relief for them because they can cry, they can express themselves, they can say, they give testimonies of what happened.
Some critics have taken issue with Rwanda's memorials, which strongly emphasize that ethnic Tutsis, the vast majority of the 800,000 people killed, were the ones targeted by extremist Hutus, while paying less attention to moderate Hutus who also died. Karengera argues that during the genocide, Hutus were only killed because they refused to kill, were married to a Tutsi, or they physically resembled Tutsi.
So those Hutus also are among the people whom we call victims of genocide against the Tutsi. But we call it genocide against the Tutsi simply because it is the Tutsi who were targeted for extermination. It is not the Hutu.
Rwanda officially begins commemoration of the genocide on April 7th in Kigali, when President Paul Kagame lights a national flame of mourning with a torch that has been touring across the country since the beginning of the year. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Kigali.
And as this year marks the 20th anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda, there has been a global movement to remember and educate people about what happened. Some survivors are sharing their painful memories in the United States, hoping students will listen and learn from what happened. Elizabeth Lee reports from Los Angeles.
I saw women get raped at 4 years old.
Yannick Tonas survived a horror most people will never experience. He's been educating students around the world by telling his story. Today, he is at the University of Southern California.
I remember the first time I saw the killing, and first time I saw people being killed, the first time I saw bodies.
These firsts happened in Rwanda when Tona was only 4 years old.
Hiding in the bushes, hear people screaming with machetes, full blood, bodies on the street, everywhere.
Among those killed were Tona's one-year-old brother and grandmother. Edith Umu Giraneza, who was 16 during the genocide, struggled with the fact that she survived, while her mother, brothers, and many other relatives did not.
Surviving for me was a problem, because I was blaming, why did I survive? Why I didn't go with others? Why? I had the question, why all the time?
Her story is a part of the video archive at the University of Southern California Shoah Foundation, the Institute for Visual History and Education. The Institute has been collecting video testimonies of survivors of the Holocaust and other genocides. For Rwanda, it aims to collect at least 500 testimonies. So far, 65 are in its visual history archive. The Institute is also involved with Kwibuka 20. It is a series of events worldwide and in the virtual world that commemorate the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide, offering education, healing, and hope.
We know about what happened to ensure that this cannot happen again.
USC Shoah Foundation's Stephen Smith is the executive director of Kwibuka 20.
People all around the world are coming together as a world community to reflect on what happened, but also to leave their voice and to make their point of view very clear about genocide in the world today, what we can do about that, how we can be involved.
University students Nora Snyder and Gregory Irwin are passionate about getting involved after a research trip to Rwanda, where they met Yannick Tona and heard his story and the testimonies of other survivors.
I've been more driven to do something about genocide than ever.
Things like what happened in Rwanda are still going on in the world today, and things will continue to happen unless we take the time to remember.
A global movement.
As a part of the Shoah Foundation Institute Student Association, they're organizing events on campus, including opportunities to hear Edith Umugiraneza's and Yannick Tona's personal stories.
People tried to kill me.
The aim is to make people care enough to do something to prevent or stop any future genocides. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15.5, 80 and 60 80 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehei Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopez, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Concerned about the continuing violence in South Sudan, the United States has established a new authority to sanction those who are contributing to the crisis. President Barack Obama signed an order on April 3rd authorizing economic sanctions to be imposed on those in the troubled East African nation who threaten its stability or who commit human rights abuses. Specific individuals are not named, but the action grants the U.S. Treasury Department and U.S. State Department the authority to designate for sanctions those who obstruct the peace process, violate the January 23rd cessation of hostilities agreement, or who commit human rights abuses. Under the order, any property held in the United States by an offending party would be blocked and its assets here frozen. Individuals and businesses receiving payment or assets from those sanctioned would also see those monies and assets blocked. The action is needed, President Obama said, because the ongoing widespread violence in South Sudan, the atrocities, human rights abuses, recruitment and use of child soldiers, attacks on peacekeepers, and obstruction of humanitarian operations constitute a national emergency. We call on all of South Sudan's leaders to honor their commitments by working quickly and earnestly towards an inclusive and comprehensive political dialogue. With the International Authority on Development and other partners in the region, we will continue to support the expedited release of those detained in Juba and elsewhere, and to ensure their meaningful participation in a political dialogue. Given the needs of the thousands of South Sudanese who have been displaced by the fighting, we also call on the parties to facilitate aid by humanitarian groups to all in need, regardless of location. The United States continues to stand with the people of South Sudan, the United Nations mission there, and all those working under difficult and dangerous conditions to alleviate the suffering and protect innocent civilians affected by the crisis.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials. On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story.
putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.